The program you're about to listen to is not recorded in front of a live studio audience. Nevertheless, put your hands together for Before a Live Studio Audience, the 90s sitcom podcast. Welcome to Before a Live Studio Audience, the only show where absurdly large amounts of time are dedicated to asking one big question. What is it about 90s sitcoms that binds us together? More than any other TV genre or entertainment medium, why is it the sitcom that evokes the strongest senses of nostalgia and the most versatile senses of community? I'm your host, Damon Sutton, and joining me today is my good friend, Dylan Saville.
Thanks for having me here, Damo, in the audience.
The audience, handpicked, yeah. Handpicked out of a, I would say, nigh on 100 people.
A little sounding board, a test audience.
Come on down. Dill, my friend, what is your experience with 90s sitcoms? How have they kind of helped formulate your humor and what you find funny?
It's interesting. I guess I would... There's always been a spot for 90s sitcoms in my heart because it was sort of programmed into watching commercial television. And I remember Sunday nights was the night for me that really sticks out if I think of 90s sitcoms. So I think if I recall, the programming was Home Improvement.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, you had, that was at 7:30. Then at 8 on a Sunday night, you would have Third Rock from the Sun. And then that would go into the Sunday night movie. But those two sort of pillars were really like, oh, okay, this is... this is sort of my benchmark. And I think also Friends bleeds into that as well. Monday nights, 7:30. And, another one, the Drew Carey Show.
Yes,
so these are all sort of foundation sort of sitcoms that you sort of... We were lucky enough to grow up with in the time in that late 90s, little early 2000s bubble. And, yeah, I really sort of took a lot of it on, I think.
And was it a family thing? Or was it more you being on your own, discovering your own tastes?
Good question. I think I do recall my mother being interested in Friends as well as Third Rock from the Sun because she thought it was kooky.
Kooky. Yeah. Good ringing endorsement.
But I think it's more of my own sort of direction with that sort of thing. It's kind of hard to tell because as a kid, you were kind of, you know, I was really keen just to watch the shows that I wanted to watch. South Park came on TV in 97. I was really keen to watch that, although I was sort of censored, wasn't allowed to watch that.
Oh.
Yeah, but yeah, I kind of found my way around it. So, yeah, I kind of really gravitated towards like Third Rock from the Sun and Friends, I think, were the two pillars.
And what about those two sitcoms attracted you? Was it the believable situations, the characters, the setting, the ideas within it? Or was it just basically, this was on TV, this makes me laugh, it's the humor element that really draws me.
I think it was the characters. And if I think of Friends, I think of it as a young boy, grumpy, watching the character Matt LeBlanc, Joey Tribbiani in Friends.
And forget about it. Pastrami.
Yeah, loves to eat food. Who knew? But I always was... and Chandler as well. Matt Perry?
Yeah, Matt Perry.
And very comedic, quite slapsticky cartoon characters of people in this sort of normal setting. And, you know, there's light and shade in these things where they're serious. But I think I was gravitated towards them. And with Third Rock from the Sun, I could think of John Lithgow, you know, big, you know, would be like theatre-trained actor, knows how to command a space.
A thespian.
A thespian of sorts.
Of course.
So I think now that I talk about it and hear myself listening to it, it's... very drawn to these larger-than-life cartoon characters on the screen.
And also those characters, though, are quite embedded in the world. They're quite successful still. They're not marginalized weirdos. Chandler isn't a pathetic fool. He still comes off as someone with confidence and someone you can kind of look up to in a way.
Yeah, I think so. But also fallible because I remember this one strange story arc in Friends where Chandler's father comes out as gay. And he's really scared of it. Then his father gets a sex change or something. This is true.
What?
Look it up. And his father becomes, you know, there's this whole transvestite story arc. You know, his father becomes trans. And he's like, I don't know how to feel about it. Everyone's just like, hey, chill out. It's New York. Whatever.
Everybody's somebody, baby.
Yeah, forget about it.
What? I'd love it if that was the pilot episode.
It's interesting. I remember with Friends, the pilot episode, they're not sitting in a coffee shop. They're sitting in a bar.
Oh.
Yeah, they are.
Very Cheers-esque.
They're looking all really dolled up, these slick versions, you know, these young mid-20s actors just coming out of all this training. And yeah, we're going to be on the hit, like, sitcom, the definitive sitcom of the 90s. It really had that vibe. And then it found its own voice. But
yeah,
if you watch the very first episode of Friends, it's almost unrecognizable.
Same as Seinfeld.
Yeah.
The beats in Seinfeld are totally different. It's a lot more relaxed, almost passive viewing. Whereas later Seinfeld, really strong beats, canned laughter all the way through. The first season of Seinfeld is almost like a soap opera. It's unrecognizable.
Ooh. So I think these things, they get thought up in board meetings and they go, this will be great.
Yeah.
But the real nuggets, and it's great with people like Larry David staying on there, man, like you can see in Seinfeld too, the two driving forces. Like, it's probably just good timing and a bunch of circumstances that they actually got to drive that show in their own direction after, you know, these shaky pilots.
The execs and the hired creative control kind of put their hands away a bit and let the show have a bit more autonomy. And that's a running theme throughout all these sitcoms, is the good ones, the ones that last, are the ones that have creative autonomy. The writers and the showrunners are the ones that are the most invested in it, and they have the strongest view for how the show should be. Speaking of strong shows, dude, what do you think of when you hear this? This is the 1 hour version.
So, oh, good. All right, well, sit in.
I'll give you time to think.
Yeah, thank you. No, it makes me think of Thursday nights, because I remember it was on Thursday nights at one point. And I remember in the late 2000s, it was also getting aired again on one of the free-to-air sister channels to Channel 7 or something.
Really?
Yeah, Becker. So I remember it was like Thursday night. It would go from Becker into Letterman. I remember the reruns, yeah.
That is so, so fascinating to me, because for me, a lot of these sitcoms, Everybody Loves Raymond, Becker, Cheers, are daytime watching.
Oh.
Because I grew up later on when these sitcoms are just almost filler for daytime shows. So for me, Becker Speaks coming home from school, 3:30.
Well, that's interesting, because I do remember a time when that happened as well. But okay. I think the original run, it was paired on Thursday nights, just after Scrubs.
Okay.
Interestingly, so Scrubs would air about 7:30 and Becker would be the kicker afterwards on 8 o'clock.
Isn't that bizarre? When shows, the way we treat and even think about daytime television programming to nighttime television programming is night and day.
Mm.
For me, Becker is this harmless kind of chaff almost. You have it on the background when you come home from school. You have your snack, that's on there. And then you do something else. It's not the appointment viewing. You're not giving your attention towards it. It's background.
Interestingly enough, I have sat in a doctor's waiting room watching Becker on the TV during the day. Sitting in the waiting room watching it happen, I just remember it felt a little bit Inception-y. But it is funny when these shows get relegated to the daytime TV audience. I can think of many summers in school holidays as a kid watching the movies that get shafted in there, and then in turn the TV shows too, mostly Channel 7, I think.
So I'm going to go through the IMDb description of Becker, because I love the IMDb description. Because it's so stony-faced, it's so devoid of humor. When you actually have to explain the plot and the world of a sitcom, it really makes a bit of kind of a very boring derivative story, because there's so many gaps in it.
Yeah, your elevator pitch?
Totally. And it'll be hard pitching Becker. It's Dr. John Becker goes through his daily routine of being a doctor.
Oh, cool.
Stopping at his favorite diner.
Checks out.
And other various situations. All while hating life and everything around him. So if you're a TV exec, you can get that on your table. He's a doctor. He's not very happy. He goes to a diner and he hates life around him. You're going to be putting that in the bin.
Well, the whole thing about Becker is like, that does sound very dry.
Mm.
But it had the momentum coming off Cheers. It's a spin-off. It lives totally. It lives in this own universe. So to pitch that to the executives, I think it was CBS.
Mm.
Back there in the night. I think it started in 98.
Yes.
Yeah, so it started in 98 off the back of Cheers, which finished in the early 90s. They already had this sort of built-up world around it. Frasier comes into that world as well. They're just a little bit branching off. So I feel like the whole show is just based around Ted Danson, who plays Becker. His chemistry and he's just running the ship. The show is built around him. The fact that he's a boring doctor hanging out in a diner is kind of secondary, which is what I love about Becker. About the whole show, like this whole universe is just built around this man's irritability of the world around him. And the fact that everyone else is just like little pawns in this thing, just like niggling at him. I think that's where the great content comes from.
Cheers really kind of created a situational comedy, whereas the two subsidiaries from that, Frasier and Becker, really launched incredibly character-driven sitcoms that weren't ensemble cast, really centering on one or a couple of individual characters, which you look at sitcoms before then, Roseanne, Different Strokes, things like that. But it comes from these family-orientated situational comedies, and then you get things like Cheers, which is a bit more adult and edgy, but still situational. And then we get the natural evolution of that, which are complete character-orientated sitcoms. Becker and Frasier, and then later on Seinfeld. So you can really track this rising cynicism and edginess in sitcoms from the family appointment viewing to these characters, these individual, very parochial-based worlds where the whole world revolves around one character who's very cynical and multi-layered. And Becker, I think, is almost the culmination of that.
And also it feeds into like the family tree universe as well, where you've got Cheers at the top and these other characters. Becker and Frasier really are a bit of a flashpoint in this sort of the sitcom and the branching off. And if you look into it, there are some crossover characters between Becker and Frasier as well that come up as well. Between Becker and Frasier, yeah. And they used to do it too with Buffy the Vampire Slayer in the 90s and Angel.
What about Charmed?
Charmed was a different universe.
Okay.
That was Warner Brothers.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. How ballsy is that to create a cinematic universe of sitcoms? Everybody Loves Raymond is in the same universe as Becker. It's in the same universe as The Nanny. And it's in the same universe as King of Queens.
Oh, they all relate.
They have crossover episodes.
CBS's programming, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Becker also got pitched on as coming off the back of Everyone Loves Raymond to have this sort of like family night of programming as well. And when they changed the programming of Becker, they put it on different nights. They put it on Sunday nights instead of the usual nights it was on. I can't remember. But the ratings dropped. And they started dropping characters and the storyline started... You know, they started getting like, oh, what's happening? And so it's like, oh, no, it was coming off the back of Everyone Loves Raymond. People get, you know, used to it. In the States, it's crazy how these executives just chop and change and sort of things.
It's a bit of cognitive dissonance where you kind of just assume these characters, because they're layered and structured together, you assume there's the same world there. You assume there's some sort of crossover there, and they actually feed that by having an actual crossover. Once you take one away, it's a symbiotic relationship. The other one suffers too. As I say in the Frasier podcast, Frasier is incredibly ballsy in that the show has no working place commonalities. It is about a aloof toff, living in a sky-rise building. He's a radio personality. He's someone who's educated. This is not the nuclear American. This is not the standard American. And to have people expect people to empathize with that character and see the artifice of it, the humor of this man's shortcomings, is incredibly brave. Alternatively, we have Becker, who a lot more of a working class element. The sets aren't penthouse sets.
It's quite stark.
Yeah. Totally. The sets are dirty, it's gritty, it's streety. Completely the opposite to Frasier. Mm. Both of them work in the same way, though. They're these characters that are kind of hard to empathize with, especially Becker, too. But because of their flaws and their shortcomings, that's the empathy almost. Frasier's shortcoming is he can't connect with his dad properly. Becker's shortcoming is he can't connect with the world properly. And that is a commonality there, regardless of the situation and the people.
I think that's... Yeah, you touched on the main thing there with Becker that I find is that, you know, he's such like an irritable person with everyone around him. But he's got these, say, about four or five people, like, you know, the characters in the show, but they're all very loyal to him. And they share in him because he, like, you know... He's a doctor, he's irritable, but, you know, again, he's got the higher income. He can actually, like, look after these people and bring them into his own world a little bit. And you always find at the end of the episode, there's a whole compassion element to
an episode,
which I think is replicated in Everyone Loves Raymond. And Frasier as well. And they just sort of bring on, but blah, 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 but blah, 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 but blah, blah, blah. And aren't we all here together? And I think it comes off, too, with characters in the show, like Jake, like the blind dude as well, like, you know, he's got all these crazy things happening. You're like, oh, what a funny different angle. This is the guy that hangs out in the diner next to Becker's work. And always you know, trouble things going on. And like, oh, but he's, you know, he's actually blind. And how does that actually affect him? Because like so many Americans actually are blinded people. Like, what's it like living in a big city and stuff? But you get Becca hanging shit on him and stuff, blah, blah, blah. You know, hey, you're cranky, but you're blind. Yeah. I think it plays into a really interesting dynamic as well. And you also got characters like Bob, who comes in, who's like the really obnoxious Italian-American
Bob.
Character.
Yeah. Why won't you sleep with me?
Yeah. Also, interestingly, got written out of the show.
Yes, because the actor left.
Yep.
And then they replaced him with the guy from Lost.
Yep.
The big boy.
Oh, Hurley.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely.
Yeah. Good point there, in that the character of Jake is designed to anchor Becca, where we see Becca's little nitpicks, oh, his little world, it's so bad, and then you bring in this character, oh, this is actually someone who has genuine problems, who is happy, and who isn't brought down by the minutiae of the world. Very similar replicated in Frasier. You got Frasier, oh, my world is so awful, but then you see his dad, soul to the earth Marty, he's got the walking cane, his life could potentially be quite lonely, but he's making do. His wife's gone, he's making do. All that kind of little torment of modern life that Frasier has is put into perspective. So both these characters, the thing that stops them from being egotistical and awful are these characters, the side characters that give perspective. And another common trait for both these characters, Becca and Frasier, is that both of them, they seem a bit mean, they seem a bit caught up in their own problems, but like you said, you watch this in with the knowledge, with this internalized kind of understanding that at the end, they're going to come good. Becca, he won't treat this patient right now, but you know, at the end, there's a method to his madness. And I think that's an incredibly strong bit of trust that the show ingrains in you, where you know, okay, we're going to pull this out far. Beck is going to be an absolutely awful person, but you know, don't worry, you're in safe hands, that he's going to be brought back and he's going to be a character that you can empathize with and enjoy.
I think that's bang on.
Yeah.
And I can think of one episode that doesn't follow that formula to a T.
Really?
It's really interesting. So there's this whole bit where someone finds that Becca was in a barbershop quartet in college. Have you seen this?
Vaguely. I can't remember.
Becca, they find out Becca is in a barbershop quartet, so a little singing a cappella group with three other people. And they find out one of his songs that sort of, you know, apparently did well in the charts in some places. And so each character in their own way starts like humming the tune the language around and going, what did you just say? And you're like, oh yeah, nothing, blah, blah, blah. And like they do it through the whole episode. And it's just like, it's a classic gag. It just keeps on going on and on, but it doesn't come into the whole full circle thing. And they're just like railing him. It's just really funny. And then they're all just bullying him by the end of the episode. He's like, oh, what's going on here? It's really funny. And like, you just leave the episode going, huh? Okay, maybe they had it in for him that day in the writing room.
Maybe Ted Danson was a douche.
Yeah, maybe.
And sitcoms can be quite disturbing once that trust is taken away. Once that tension is never broken, it just stays there.
Mm.
It can be incredibly worrisome. And one of the reasons that Seinfeld was so amazing was because they tethered that tension. They never brought it back. The characters didn't learn anything. They didn't hug it out at the end.
No, it's selfish.
Selfish.
So selfish.
And that's why Seinfeld was so successful, because you're waiting for this, oh, I guess George is going to learn his lesson.
No, he's just neurotic.
No, he's awful.
Yeah.
He's a bad person. That is an interesting little take on sitcoms there. Mm. Look, I might just read out a couple of interesting little Becca facts.
Oh, hit me up.
So there's been, as we were talking about before, there's been numerous references to Danson's former series Cheers. Cheers co-stars George Wendt, Rhea Perlman, and Kelsey Grammer have all appeared on Becca. So once again, there's that, which is kind of bizarre because Cheers, Ted Danson plays a different character. So this is actually out of universe. This is something that's not within the world we're established here. And you have to have prior knowledge as to who these characters are, because obviously Becca's not going to go, oh, my friends from the bar. Whereas Kelsey Grammer's character Frasier can do that. And there is an episode where he talks about the Cheers crew in Frasier. Becca, they kind of have that luxury. It's casting wink. It's like a bit of a casting, you know, nudge and a wink. That's the only one I have, actually. Dill, how many rose-tinted glasses would you give Dr. John Becker and the show Becker out of 10?
I'm going to give it a solid 6.75.
That's not bad.
Mm.
That's good.
Yeah, I think it holds up well. If you ever go back and watch any episodes, or you're hanging out there in your midday TV haze and you're watching Becker, there's It's still compelling to watch, I think, as well, but it has aged well, and at the end of the day, you know, these characters are always compassionate and learning and stuff. I think they're still just hollow. Mm. There's nothing really to be learned. Yeah, there's characters in there, like, trying to talk about transsexuality or, you know, the American politics at the time as well. It just kind of falls flat in hindsight. It's like, nah, you know, you were just ticking boxes in the writing room.
If you're expecting civil rights in Becca, you're going to be left a little bit short. Dill, thank you so much for joining me today on Before Live Studio Audience.
Thank you for taking me back there, Damo.
Oh, just let this gorgeous theme take us out. You've been listening to Before Live Studio Audience, the 90s sitcom podcast. I'm Damon. Join us next week for more 90s sitcom fun.